Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is producer, educator, and musicologist Eric Copeland. First of all, let's talk about net neutrality. Well, you've probably heard by now that the FCC has ruled against net neutrality. And what exactly does that mean? Well, first of all, it means that up until now, we've had pretty much unlimited use of the internet. So in other words, you pay your fee, whatever it might be, $49 a month or $89 a month, whatever it is, and then you could pretty much download whatever you want. You can use a service as much as you want. You can go to Spotify, use it as much as you want. And if you use it a little bit or a lot, you've paid the same. So there's no increase that goes along with usage. Now, this may change now the fact that we won't have net neutrality anymore. So in other words, an ISP or a telco, whoever you have your internet with, will be able to charge you for usage. In other words, they might say, well, you only get 100 songs a month. And after that, then we charge you extra. So that's not too cool. The other thing is they can also force you to their preferred provider. In other words, if you're with AT&T, AT&T might have a deal with Tidal. It's easier for you to change from Spotify to Tidal than it is for you to change from AT&T to Sprint. In fact, what'll happen is it will force you to be a Tidal user rather than a Spotify user. What's happening here is AT&T or whoever your provider is getting paid on both sides. You're paying extra, and then Tidal or Spotify or whoever the service provider is will also have to pay the ISP or the telco to have you access it. So here we have a changing of the guard, so to speak. Up until now, what's happened is the people in the middle, the telephone companies, the telcos, and the ISPs, they have all this infrastructure that they pay a lot of money for, but they can only charge so much, and there's lots of regulations. And basically what happens is all the rights holders, all of the record labels and publishers, they are able to really come down on a service provider like Apple Music or like Tidal or like Spotify and get higher royalties and advance payments and things like that. But now that's going to change a little bit. As now the Spotify's and Apple Music's of the world will now have to deal with the people in the middle, which is the ISPs, internet service providers, and the telcos, and they'll have to pay extra for that. So this is kind of a changing of the guard. The ISPs and telcos are now sort of gatekeepers in the middle, and they'll be making money from both sides. Good for them, bad for consumers. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. The second edition of my social media promotion for musicians handbook is now available on Amazon, iBooks, Ingram, and a bookstore near you. It's the manual for marketing yourself, your band, and your music online, and it covers how to use virtually every important online platform for promotion. Also, check out my online video courses at bobbyosinskicourses.com. Now, you hear me talk a lot about Gibson, and one of the reasons why is it's not that I don't like the company, because I do, and I like the product, and I'm a Gibson owner, but they've made a lot of suspect decisions and suspect business moves over the last 10 or 15 years, and now they're coming home to roost. You might have heard that a few weeks ago, it wasn't all that long, it was last month in November, Gibson put up their Memphis factory for sale. It's a showroom and it's also a factory in beautiful downtown Memphis. Less than a month later, a real estate investment group bought that particular property. And it's interesting because it's the same group that actually bought two warehouses from Gibson earlier in the year. So this group is funding Gibson right now for the short term. The other thing that Gibson did is it pushed back a big payment from the beginning of December to the end of December to take advantage of the cash flow that comes with Christmas. That being said, Gibson has some real problems because it has $520 million of debt that's going to be due in mid-2018. And they're not able to borrow any more money because their credit is not that good. So who knows what'll happen? The Memphis factory is going to be turned into retail space and offices and a brewery. Too bad, because it's actually a really nice tourist stop now. They have a wonderful factory tour, and even going to the showroom is pretty nice, but that's all going away, and they'll be in it for another couple of years until they transition to another place in Memphis or back to Nashville. But it's really a shame because it was a great place. My guest today is Eric Copeland, who's become one of the top Christian and jazz producers in the country, producing around 25 artists every year. His specialty is not just music, but guiding and growing artists thanks to his decades of experience. Eric also has a deep interest in music history and writes a blog called Music History Matters. I spoke with him via Skype from a studio in Nashville. I looked at all of your websites, and you're prolific. There's a lot going on. How would you describe yourself?
Well, I think, you know, in this day and age, you've really got to kind of be an entrepreneur. What I have found is that you got to be careful that you don't have too many brands. But at the same time, you know, us creative guys, and you're one of these people, you know, we have a lot of different interests. And some of us, I think, are it's easier for us to do many things at one time versus just concentrate on. There was probably a time in your life you really just concentrated on engineering or producing and things like that. And there was a time that, you know, I did things like that too. But I think these days you've got to, I tell people a lot of times that I wear a lot of hats, and I can't think of the expression right now. But, you know, I know that there's a lot of things to do, and I have backgrounds in so many things. You know, my life was coming up in a musical family, but also in a tech family, and also in a church family. And so all of these things have kind of just come along. I had a background in tech. You know, I worked doing websites and CD-ROMs and DVD-ROMs and multimedia back in the 90s when, you know, we were making little 640 by 480 screens to show multimedia in. And of course, that's all different now. But, you know, I did that work. I worked as in professional video for a few years, all the time being a songwriter and kind of making my own music since I was 13 years old. And so that's what started it all. But my dad brought home an IBM PC in like 1980. And he worked at IBM. And so I learned BASIC and DOS and just kind of figured out how to start doing computer stuff. So through all my life, even though I was a musician and trying to be, thought I was going to be a songwriter, you know, and just go over to Nashville and make my fortune, you know, there was just a lot of different roads I ended up on because of tech and then because of video. And then as it turns out, they all led to here, where having my own business and having, you know, dozens of clients at a time that you're trying to work for and help as artists and grow them as artists, they all kind of come together.
Well, let's look at the number of things you do, because it's quite a lot. So you're a blogger and you have four blogs, right?
Yeah. There's probably more than that, actually. But the main one I've done since for about 15 years now. Before there was blogging, it was just a newsletter before. But it was called For the Creative Soul, and it was really just for creatives. You know, I work mainly, if you look at the genres, I'm a genre producer, mainly in the Christian and gospel genre, but then also in the jazz. And now we're starting to do some classical genre stuff too. But, the For the Creative Soul really applies to everyone. It's really I've written a book and I'm sitting on it right now, but it's just basically from the blog through all the years, just about all the stages of living a creative life and what that's like for people who are amateurs, who are semi-pros, and who are professionals. All of us have the same problems and same things we have to deal with. as creatives. And so it kind of goes into that a lot. And then I have one called the music ministry business, which I might be shifting more into the music, just more of a music business blog, similar kind of to what you do, just because it seems I'm talking about Twitter and I'm talking about, you know, just things that apply to everyone. Since I was so based in gospel music for the most part, and especially over the last 10 or 15 years in Nashville, you know, most of 90% of the clients I have are based in that genre, which is a pretty big genre in Nashville, obviously. But and it's one of the points I want to make today as we talk is the importance of genre and the importance of staying in your lane and working at your particular craft, because I don't know how anybody as a pop artist or a rock artist figures out a way to go when, you know, I work mostly in the genres, and it's a little easier because you know exactly who to contact for publicity and for all those kind of things.
Let's talk about your production career, because I know you mentioned to me in an email about you have a lot of clients and you do a lot online. I want to know how you do that. What's the basis of your production career?
Well, I started in Lexington, Kentucky, which is where I'm from. And I worked in my basement like everybody else with Cakewalk. And then I started with an engineer in town who used Logic on the Mac. And so I started using Logic on the PC. This is how long ago this was, when Logic was actually on the PC as well. And because I found it as a keyboard player and an arranger and MIDI kind of guy, I found that MIDI and Logic was so much easier, especially since, and still, you can go back to the beginning of time, 10 or 20 years later, and get your MIDI unquantized if you want to, because it's non-destructive. And so I've always used Logic since then, and it continues to be the main thing that I use now. I just started producing people. Gosh, you know, this isn't something I planned to do. I didn't even know that there was such a thing as producer. I looked at records all my life, you know, the back of them, and I saw producer. But I just started writing songs and making my own tapes. And my dad had a reel-to-reel player. He was a musician and microphones. And so I started making my own recordings. And the next thing I knew, friends were asking me, this may sound familiar, you know, hey, can you record me? Can you do this for me? And I just became the guy that suddenly I was the guy that recorded people locally. And I recorded people in high school and in college. And then I moved to Chicago for a while. And I worked with people there and recorded people there. And then when I came back to Kentucky, I just started putting out a shingle as a producer, arranger, and a composer. And what happened was, again, because of my computer background, about 1995 or so, I picked up a book at Barnes & Noble or someplace, and it was How to Program HTML. And because I worked in tech, I already knew markup language. And so I'm like, dang, I know HTML. I know how to make a website. So the next day, EricCopelandMusic.com was probably up. And that was 95. And so I've had a website since about then. By 97, people were tracking me down from California. And I was in Kentucky, of all places. And they're coming from every point in the United States because mainly, again, I was specifically focused a lot in Christian music. And in the 90s, people were typing into Alta Vista or whatever search engine there was at that time, you know, how do I find a Christian music producer? Or if they want a jazz music producer or whatever. And so people were finding me because of my specialties. And I think that's continues to be, and the website continues to be the main way people find me. They just type into Google what they're looking for. And as far as I know, I've been in the top one or two as if you type in Christian music producer for about 10 years, wow. Maybe at least certainly the last 5 or 7. So that's been, and then when you back it up with the people that I was lucky enough to meet in Nashville, I can tell that story, but you know, that plus the quality of Nashville and all the players that I was lucky enough to meet, engineers, just kind of made it all happen. And word of mouth is still a thing, but I don't think word of mouth is as big as Google's mouth, you know, as far as finding my website, because again, I've had that set up for a long time in some form. And so it's just very findable. And the blogs don't hurt, and social media doesn't hurt, and all that doesn't hurt. But I still think it's people typing in people tell me all the time, you're not going to believe how God led me to you.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I think I probably can figure it out.
Well, what type of clients do you have, production clients?
Well, I would say they're mostly all independent. I am not necessarily in the star making business. And what I mean by that is that's never really interested me all that much. I tell a lot of people, and I still operate this way. I started basically professionally as a composer arranger for jobs. People would want a song for a wedding, or they would want to record a song for their wife or for their girlfriend or for a specific event or something. And I would do that kind of thing. And then I kind of took over a business where they were doing a lot of jingle writing, and it was this actual physical studio. And so I became more of whoever walked in the door, I would help. And as a studio, that's not about looking for stars. That's looking about billable hours. And so to me, it was all about staying busy and living a life of producing music at that time. I got to write a lot back then, a little bit more than I do now, because the whole artist writer thing has changed. For the most part, my business has almost always been independent. And every once in a while, I'll work with or for somebody who is doing something that's related to a label or something like that. But, you know, not to get all Christian or anything, but on you, but, you know, from a Christian music point of view, the goal is not fame. The goal is to get the message out and to get people to hear it. And so it's very easy from that point of view to produce music for people to go out and do things with. And I think jazz is a similar way. I think classical is a similar way. That's probably why I love those three genres, because they're really about the music for a reason, not just for dancing or for attention or for whatever that particular genre might be about. And so those clients come to me and I help them build full, because of my background, again, in social media, or before social media, in website building and all that kind of stuff, my background, photography and design and Photoshop and all that kind of stuff, I can help people kind of build not only a great sounding record or track or whatever, but, you know, we've always been the place, especially before we moved to Nashville, that was out of town that could help a local or regional artist build an entire brand.
Full service, so to speak. Yeah.
It's basically like we are a record company. We say we're Creative Soul Records a lot, and it doesn't necessarily mean that we're a record label that sells records, but we pretty much do everything a record label does.
Well, how sophisticated are the clients that you get?
Well, they run the gamut. They could be as sophisticated as a 24-year-old super talented young lady that, as a matter of fact, I had a lady today, a young lady meeting with A&R at Word in Nashville, which is, you know, a large Christian label. And so I introduce artists to them from time to time. As you know, that's just an introduction. Those kind of things take a long time to happen, if they ever happen at all. But I do that kind of thing. And so I work with artists that are talented like that. But, you know, again, now, jazz and classical aside, in the gospel industry, talent is not always the big part of the whole thing. You know, so I've got several artists on the road doing 100, 200 dates a year, and I wouldn't say that they're any more talented than, you know, as far as pure talent that, you know, people see, because one of them is probably 60 or so, and another one is 30 or usually probably 40 or so with his entire 7-member family in an RV traveling around. So, but, you know, they would consider themselves successful and making it, and they're making a living and they're having their fun touring and all that kind of stuff. And then there are people who are come into meeting us, and they're not very good songwriters, but over the years they become pretty good songwriters. And then there are people who are people who just need a track, and I just developed 10 tracks for some artists in Australia who just needed great sounding professional Nashville sounding Christian tracks for their business. I'm not even sure what their business is, but it's some care business or something. and they're going to redo some vocals there, but we had pros sing in Nashville for it. So it's just, it runs the gamut. It's like being in a studio.
Funny you should mention, I have a very, very good longtime friend, and recently she said, I'm going to Nashville, I'm going to record some songs. I didn't think much of it when she was telling me that. I just didn't think hard about it. Well, she came back and she said, okay, I have these songs. Can you mix them for me? I said, yeah, sure. So she sends them over, and there's 8 songs that she did in 4 days. And these things sound so good. I mean, even the rough sound terrific. It's like, wow, I'm going to work really hard to beat these things. But my point is the quality of musicianship and the quality of the engineering and the quality of everything was just so high. I don't know what she paid for this, but it probably it was a reasonable amount. But wow, I was knocked out.
4 days is a lot for 8 songs. I mean, I tracked on Friday, and we did 8 songs that day. And we spent about an hour and a half on every song. Maybe someone went a little faster, and they all sound fabulous. But these are guys, and people ask me all the time, how can they play do this? But as you know, great session players who live every day and only play every day are amazing at this. And I just happened to meet the right engineer who was in the middle of the whole Christian world. And then I've met another engineer and same thing, two guys who anything they mix is just fabulous. And they both have Grammys and Doves and all that kind of stuff. But the players they use are the main guys who have been there for 20, 30 years, you know, and some of them now are out on tour with Michael McDonald. He's got quite a few of them in his band now. And Peter Cetera has a few in his band, and the drummer I worked with, as a matter of fact, on Fridays in Peter Cetera's current band. And, you know, these are top of the line guys. They could have made it in any either in L.A. or Nashville. And some of them have worked in L.A. before and then came here or have gone back and forth.
Yeah, but it's something. I mean, in L.A., there are fewer of those guys around. And for some reason, they're tougher to get. I mean, you can, but in Nashville, it just seems like there's an overabundance of really great players. Yeah, it seems that way to me. I haven't lived there. I've worked there, but I haven't lived there. But it just seems to me that, wow, the average quality level is much higher than most places.
5 to 10 deep at every place, I would say, at that top level.
Yeah.
And if somebody has to take a double scale thing, which doesn't happen as much as it used to, but if that should happen, they take it, you can find somebody who can come in and cover just as well at just as high quality. And now I'm pretty particular about that high quality, because that's kind of how I get the quality of what we do. And that's always going to depend on the artist, because the artist can come in with a great song or a mediocre song. They can be a great singer or a mediocre singer. Again, my business is not based on who's the best, and every track is going to be what that artist wanted, because in some ways they're the executive producer of their own product.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know how that goes. Yeah. But
tell me about your book.
Well, I've written a few. I actually wrote a book before I moved to Nashville, and it was a music producer's guide type of thing, you know, and it was so funny. I wrote it long before I moved to Nashville, and I really wrote it as if you are not in Nashville, LA, or New York, how do you get something produced locally, you know, or regionally, and what do you watch out for? Mm-hmm. And that was kind of what I wrote it for. I still sell it on my site. When I moved to Nashville, I had to really kind of change some things, because my mind was completely open to what's out there in Nashville and or LA or wherever. But, because I learned it became so much about players. I mean, there's something that I have to do as an arranger or a producer and to keep things under control. There's engineers like I had in Kentucky. And then there's like the guys in Nashville, yeah. You know, the top guys, you know, and they, so I had to rewrite a little bit of it, and I haven't really checked on it in a year or two. I think I rewrote it a little bit a couple of years ago. You know how that goes. You have to kind of update things a little bit, but it still works mainly as a book to help the person who's local. But the problem is now I don't recommend people work local, because the problem with local is I remember I used to be a local guy. I don't know if you were ever a local guy, but oh, yeah. I was at the time I was a local guy. And I thought I knew everything in that local area. And then I moved to Nashville and realized didn't really know everything. And so after moving there and learning this, I learned that it's all about the people around you. It's all about finding the best person for the job, just like being a contractor. I think that's the best example of what a producer is a great contractor.
Yeah.
And finding the right people. And so now it's very hard for me to suggest people record in their local studio, because I know that likely there's someone going to make some decisions based on they thinking that they are the king of the town. Now, I also have another book. It's called How to Live a Creative Life, and it's basically for all creatives. I believe this book is a little bit more based in the Christian format, and it would probably be pushed into the Christian bookstores more than, but I've also thought about rewriting it as a book for everyone. I mean, it is a book for everyone. It's just, you know, there's some stuff in there that there's Bible verses and things like that, that some folks may have an issue with, but it's basic creative stuff, how to deal with people you live with while you try to be creative, how to convince them this is what you should do versus get a real job, all that kind of stuff. And then how to live a life as a person who tries to make a living, and how to, you know, find success as a creative, and all the pitfalls and things that you have to do trying to make a living at it.
Speaking of making a living, I was reading your bio, and right in the beginning, you mentioned about playing in a hotel touring band when you first started.
Oh, sure.
And we all played in cover bands like that, and I certainly played in something. We didn't play a lot of hotels, but I played kind of the same thing. But it got me thinking, boy, I don't think those gigs are available anymore. Is there such a thing as a band that just plays hotels anymore? That used to be a big deal, but I don't think so anymore.
Hotel, you know, because back in the day, this was mid-80s, it was Holiday Inn Lounges from here to Mankato, Minnesota, you know, and or from... and so we played all those places. I don't know if they have disc jockeys in there now, or if they just have pipe music. I don't think they have them anymore. But you know what? You see bands playing all the time. One of the things that surprised us, you got to remember, regional and local is a different deal than where we live in LA or Nashville.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a whole different world. My uncle is a superstar in Kentucky. I mean, his band that started in Lexington, and about the same time as Exile started in Lexington, you know, Exile group, and they started in Lexington. And my uncle also had a band and started and then went to Louisville and was a producer. But he's like Elvis, and you know, at some of these functions, these horse farm things, the big parties they have, and all these kind of things, those things still go on. I remember being in Minnesota at a Holiday Inn one time. And I think it was Minnesota. And we took a break from the lounge. We were walking to our room, and we walked past the big room where they were having a graduation dance. And there was a band on stage. And none of the kids were dancing. And then all of a sudden they said, "All right, now it's time to polka." And every kid went up to there and polka'd like there was no tomorrow.
Wow.
Yeah, it just shows you that all the regional stuff still goes on. Now, again, I haven't been in that world for a while, but...
You know, again, funny you should mention that. I grew up in Pennsylvania, and I'm Polish, so polka is kind of my middle name. Not that I've ever played it, but I've been around that kind of music. And because I was around it all the time, I pushed it away. But now I find it incredibly interesting. And there's a television show on the RFD network. It's called Molly B's Polka Party. And I find myself switching to that often and watching it, mostly because the bands are so good, and these bands play all the time, and they have such diverse instrumentation, like things you'd never expect. You know, there'd be three horns and an accordion, drums, you know, stuff like that, and it all works no matter what it is. And I just find them all so interesting and real, if nothing else.
I once recorded an all dulcimer band when I had a studio in Kentucky, and it was all dulcimers and one hand hammered dulcimer. The rest were just dulcimers.
Yeah.
Little shout out to Mountain Echoes somewhere in Kentucky, or where they are. But I'm just saying, you know, those kind of things exist. And you know what? That's kind of what I love. I love serving those folks, because I sell all my clients on the fact that they're just as important as anyone. You know, we all make music And the music I make is it's its own thing, and the music other people make is its own thing. And I think someone has to celebrate that and be available to those people, because otherwise everyone is, you know, still playing the old music business game of who can be a big star and how can I glom onto it. And I guess it should, again, because I love making things and I come from the production side, as probably you do, you know, I enjoy the fact that everyone gets a chance to do their thing, because you never know what's going to come out. When I've worked with Jamaican gospel singers before, where they're singing half Southern gospel, half reggae. Yeah. It's fun. It's different. It's unique. I can basically program the whole thing and add guitar, and it just is, it's fun. And the budget is really low, but yeah, it's really fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm working with a ladies group right now out of Chattanooga. And, you know, as far as singers, I wouldn't say that they're like the greatest singers that have ever come, but their songs are so fun and R&B, and I have such fun programming them, and the players have so much fun playing on them because they're funky and they're R&B and they can let loose. I mean, so you just never know who's going to come in and be interesting to work with.
Yeah.
You know, I approached that. I heard that entrepreneur guy that you talked to from, I don't know if he was from Britain or Australia, but that you just did one of your recent podcasts.
Tommy Darker from Britain. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just, you know, I love the fact that people are speaking to entrepreneurs, because I really believe in it. I'm working on my master's right now in music, because I don't have enough to do with all these blogs and 30 projects at a time, but you know how it is. People always ask me, how do you find time to do everything? I'm like, well, if you want to do it, you just do.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a hard thing to teach people, because I can't teach fire in the belly. I can teach almost everything else, but I can't teach want to. But I'm working on my master's because a part of me really wants to teach and teach people on the next, how to get to a music life, because I don't think there's the jobs out there waiting for everybody that they think there is.
I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, I go and I speak at a lot of colleges all over the world. And one of the things that strikes me is that for the most part, they're still kind of back in the Stone Age in terms of their thinking. It's, we will teach you how to get a job. And that's not the music business. The music business is you make your own job because you're an entrepreneur. So there's only a few schools that I know of that approach it from that standpoint, where they will teach entrepreneurship as part of the music program, which is the way you have to approach it if you really want to do something and stay in music as a career. So yes, I applaud you for thinking that way and for going that direction.
Well, I spent a lot of time down here in Florida now that I'm working at this, going to the school, and I'm right near Full Sail. And I finally got a chance to tour there after working with dozens of Full Sail graduates and as interns in Nashville, you know, over the years at studios that like Dark Horse and different places where I worked that always had, you know, big, big contingents of interns. And they would always be fresh out of Full Sail or some program like that. And I would say, so what are you going to do next? And they're like, well, I'm just going to try to get a job here. I'm like, okay, well, I'm sure there's just a lot of job postings all over the Nashville for engineers. But you know, I'm trying to get and they say, well, what should I do? I'm like, go back to, I said, where are you from? Toledo. I'm like, well, go back to Toledo and start a music business. Start your own place and put out stuff and start recording people, because that's what I did. And that's what almost everybody I talk to in Nashville, other than the two natives that I know live there, because everybody comes from someplace else. But everybody started as a local phenom or a local person, and then eventually brought it to town versus coming to town and hoping to make it with no experience. And I think you have to have that experience. I mean, mine is all experience. I would come to Nashville since I was 18, knocking on publishers' doors or meeting a friend that someone said, oh, you need to go see my friend in Nashville since you're a songwriter. And I'd go see that person. They didn't care to meet me. This was back in the 90s, and it was a different music business then than it is now. But, man, I would have paid someone to tell me, you know, to what I tell people now. And that is, you can do this, but you're going to have to build your own thing. And if you don't build your own thing, then it's likely not going to happen unless you just get really lucky and meet the right person for some reason. I've had interns that I've seen come in and get really nice jobs with really big producers. Now, those are usually pretty special interns. Those are usually kids who were really super talented musically. Anyway, I work with one young producer who worked with a producer named Keith Thomas for a very long time. And, you know, he was his main guy for 6-7 years. But before that, even, he was talented and gone to Berkeley. And not Berkeley Online, but real Berkeley.
Yeah, the real Berkeley. Know? Yeah, right.
And it was a great guitar player and then engineer. So that's the kind of thing it takes to get that. And most kids are going into these engineer programs because it's something fun to do, and their parents are like, "Thank God he found something! Yay, put him in there." And sometimes those programs are cheaper than a 4-year degree at something else. Maybe not necessarily some of them, but anyway. The problem is they're just not. And like you say, some are starting to incorporate entrepreneurship. Not enough. And the teachers need to teach that too. They need to be pointing out, okay, now this is why, because I'm a big music history dude. That's another one of my blogs called Music History Matters, and another one of my brands that I'm getting ready to do some more stuff for now.
Yes, I wanted to go there actually and ask you about that.
Well, we'll get there in just a second. Okay. And the reason I love music history is because I think there's a lot to apply to those of us who are working in this business. And so I think even by teaching about Mozart, Beethoven, I can teach entrepreneur lessons. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know how music history got started. I decided to go back to school about 2009 as I was, my production business was fine and it has been continually strong for quite a while, luckily. I looked at my credit hours one time on my transcript and it said 119 credit hours. And someone said to me, you know, you only need 120 for a degree, for a master's degree. So I said, you know, I should go back and just finish. So I just needed a handful of classes. So the first thing I took was a music history class just to see if I could hang. It was a 3000 level class from Haydn to now, and Western classical. And I just fell in love with it, with the study stuff. I couldn't have cared less about at 18 or 19, of course, when I was, you know, a freshman in college and literally sleeping on a desk while Beethoven was playing. I just wanted to write my songs. But I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with all the listening to the lives of them. I'm not as interested in why Bach decided to do counterpoint or anything like that. I don't really care about why he decided to put an A flat there or whatever. I know a lot of musicologists want to talk about that. That's really what they really want. I mean, there's whole books on a note or a phrase or something. I just want to teach about from the lives of them. I think their lives are so important to ours. They're applicable. And that's why music history should be taught. It shouldn't be taught from, let's make more scholarly material for scholars. Because I'm in the middle of writing 2 scholarly papers for this semester, as a matter of fact. And I'm thinking, that's fine, but I want to teach people who aren't going to be musicologists, which is 99.9% of people in the world. They are not going to be scholarly. They're going to go out and make recordings or be an artist or play in an orchestra or something like that. And I think so the important thing to teach them is the lessons from the lives of these composers, and not just composers, but anybody who worked in this. One of the guys I'm studying right now, this will really float your boat, is John Hammond. I'm doing a whole paper right now on John Hammond, who is one of our forefathers as a producer, an early producer and our guy and talent scout and writer and all this other stuff. Super interesting life, and discovered some huge artists, of course.
Yeah.
You know? Oh. So all that kind of stuff is just, I eat it up, and it's fun. And again, I have a passion, and I think you have to really work from your passions. Mm. You have to. And so that's what I try to impart to people. And I think again, that brings us back to some of the genres I work in, whether it's jazz or it's Christian or it's classical. People have a passion for those kinds of music. I just got off the phone today with a reggae artist who wants to really bring his style into contemporary pop, but also keep his reggae roots. And, you know, I think that's a lot of fun.
Very cool, Eric. Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you've either learned or maybe somebody imparted to you?
I can tell you that, well, when I first met my engineer that is a good friend of mine in Nashville, his name is Ronnie Brookshire. He's been a long time engineer in Nashville. And I first called him to see if he would start working on some of my projects because I was really burned out in Kentucky and I knew I needed to make another step. And probably there's somebody listening to this podcast somewhere that's somewhere in the United States and they've worked in their local area as long as they can. And they just know they've hit a ceiling and I had hit that ceiling and I just needed to go. And Nashville was the natural step for me because I was going back and forth anyway as doing work there and mastering and different things. But I said, Ronnie, do you work would you work with me and my artists? And he says, you know, once you get into this, you really can't get out. And that's kind of funny, but I tell you the piece of advice I wish I could go back and give myself at 18 or 19, and that is just build your own thing. Just build it. Don't wait for someone to recognize your genius. Build the thing that you want to do and start doing it, because that's the thing everybody is afraid to do. And it doesn't mean you have to quit your job and eat ramen, which I have done before, by the way, when I left tech and I went into producing full time. There was a few lean years there. But I would just say, if someone had told me that I could just, you know, they could look at all my talents and say, you know, you can do this. You have to find the people who need you to do it. And that's true in whether you're an artist, a songwriter, a producer, an engineer, whatever it is. Don't be afraid to build the thing that you want to build and take it out there. And, you know, then it's hard work. There's no doubt. But it's absolutely the thing that I wish I would have heard or somebody would have told me. I still don't think I would have cared about Beethoven at 18 years old. Or that I would have, had the guts to go to Nashville. I was going to come right out of high school and go to Belmont, but I didn't have the guts. And maybe that's another part of it. And I wish I had taken that time and put my head on straight and gone to Belmont those times, because at that time, those are now my contemporaries. All the people who were the people that graduated around the same years that I did that went to Nashville at that time and became in the music business and I later started working with, those are all my contemporaries I work with now. And I was just a little afraid, you know, when we're from a small town and we have a modicum of talent, we're sometimes afraid to jump out there and really do what we know we have to do. And so we keep hoping and waiting for someone to hear us that's going to make us a big thing. And that's just not always the best way to go, I don't think.
To find out more about Eric, go to Eric Copeland Music. That's all one word, ericcopelandmusic.com. And you can also go to creativesoulonline.com. It's all one word, creativesoulonline.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts to new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.